This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Okay, let's get the transcript. Recording has started. Okay.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann, and today I'm joined by Mawira Karatai. Yay!
Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, Mawira. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm well, and it feels like ages since we just had a talk about life, so I'm really happy about today.
Let's start with Jack. How's Jack?
Jack's actually blowing my mind at the moment. He's now 15, and so people who've been listening to us for a long time will know that we started this when he was 10, I think. Was he about 10? He was an intermediate. And he's grown up to be this remarkable young man. And last week, he walked just over 86 kilometres from Whakatane to Tauranga to raise awareness for the upcoming Māori Wards referendum. And also, people who have been with us for a while will remember when he was about 10, he stood on the steps of the Parliament and handed over the petition that allowed the law to be changed, which enabled councils to be able to have Māori wards. Then when this new government came in, they took that away, and that really blew him away, that a government could just come in and with a racist agenda, just take away something that was the right of communities to provide for themselves. He just couldn't understand how that could happen, and he wanted to do something. So that's what he chose to do, was this walk. But he walked 20 hours in 2 days, and got a very, very bad blister on the back of his, very meaty bad blister on the back of his foot, and so was supposed to do the walk back. Then that storm came over Easter, and then this week he already had other commitments, so he's decided tomorrow he's riding the route back. So he's doing an 86-kilometre ride tomorrow morning.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And has the support been good?
Massive. It's been incredible from all the truck drivers who beeped and scared the life out of him. They're big trucks, these big noises, as he's lost in his thoughts on his way. People stopped and gave him food and ice creams and just encouragement. But there was also this really weird group of people, mostly men, and they thought it was okay to say things like, oh, somebody should run him over and turn him into a game of Skittles, or roadkill waiting to happen. And I just don't get that. Like, when did that become part of who we are as people in this country? Yeah, I find that odd.
I've always thought that, you know, that sort of comments about, you know, seeing somebody on the walking and saying, oh, 10 points. That's just always seems so weird to me.
Yeah,
that thought would never enter my head, even if it's a joke.
Yeah, exactly. It's just the way they're just odd, but it comes with the rest of the language around. He's been brainwashed. He's been all sorts of weird things like that. And I just think, crikey, if somebody can tell me how to make a 15-year-old do something they don't want to do, please tell me. If you've got this magic key to making 15-year-olds do something. No, he's a I think he's been raised because all his life he's been listening to people's academic work being read to him, because that's the way that I edit stuff. I read it out loud. So he's been exposed to a phenomenal amount of really amazing information. And I think that's made him into a critical thinker. He's got a really amazing way of looking at all sides of a story and then finding what resonates with him. And that's what's happened with this Māori Wards thing. He can tell you why people disagree with him. And that's important to me. I need to know that he understands it, that he hasn't been somehow indoctrinated. Just because I believe a thing doesn't mean he should. And he can tell you the whole story. And from that, he's found the truth of it for himself. And I'm proud of that.
And so you should be. And you spent the summer learning to be a mountain bike judge or something?
Oh, my gosh. Honestly, Sam, so Jack takes up mountain biking when he was about 10. Lots of things happened when Jack was 10. He took up mountain biking. And so slowly I've been drawn into the mountain biking world. And then at the end of last year, Mountain Biking New Zealand sent out this email saying, who wants to be a commissaire? And come to this course. I'm like, oh, a course. <You know? laughs> Oh, it's shiny and new learning. So I'll do it. So I pop along to this course, not having really a clue what a commissaire does. Knowing now that I've seen them all the time at mountain biking, if you see commissaires at mountain biking, but you never have to engage with them, it means you're doing all the right things. So I pop along to this course and learn how to basically run a mountain biking event. So learn all of the rules, how to apply them, how the events should run, all of that kind of stuff. So I get to wear this very bright blue shirt. And the thing that bothered me most was the maths. I had to do a maths exam, which didn't thrill me, I can tell you. At 53, maths is not my thing, because you've got to be able to calculate
one
when
bike,
to pull people.
Two bikes.
One bike.
Three bikes.
If only it was that easy. But no, what we have to do is calculate when to pull people out of races. So if we've got a big cross-country race, it might be 200 people in the race, and we've got to take 20% of the slowest riders. So we have to calculate on the spot who are going to be those people and pull them out so that they don't get lapped and they get to maintain their mana and their riding. So it's an important job to do. But we also, I was up at Summer Hill for the North Island Schools Champs last weekend. We had cross-country, enduro and downhill. And so we're constantly looking have you got the helmet? Do you have your neck brace? You're figuring out who has to have what safety gear, making sure they've got it, making sure everyone follows the rules, making sure the trails are safe, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I love it. Never saw that coming, Sam. Did not see that coming.
So does this mean that you're biking around the course as well, or you're walking around?
Walking the course. So we have to walk the course and decide if it's safe. At Crankworks in Rotorua, when we did the track walk, it was determined that it wasn't safe for one particular age group. So that whole age group then had to have a beeline. So because if you tell a kid that they can ride a trail, then they just assume that you think that they're capable. And it might be that one or two out of 50 are capable. It might be that half of out of 50 are capable, that the other half might die. So we don't want that. Yeah, we don't want big crashes that injure people and take away their joy of the sport. So we want it to be competitive. And, yeah, it's blooming fun. So, no, I don't get actually to ride my bike. But I get to walk around with a clipboard and a blue shirt and feeling very happy that I'm contributing something to the sport for safety and good ethics.
But just walking around the course is something that you would have been thrilled to bits with a couple of years ago.
Oh, impossible a couple of years ago before my gastric sleeve surgery. Because that is, gosh, when was that? Maybe 3 years ago now, 78 kilos lost and a transformed life. Yeah, wow. Gosh, never saw that coming either. There's a whole bunch of things I never saw coming. Obviously, was never going to be a good psychic.
Let's put some music on. Let's have, or did you want, Bob Marley, Get Up, Stand Up. Why are we playing this?
It's in honour of Jack and his activism. I'm inspired by my boy at the moment. Well, I always am.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Moira,
Sam,
does about 73 jobs.
Yep. Yeah, I do. Oh, my gosh. At the moment, I've cut down a few things. I had to, because I'm really just trying to put in as much time with Jack as I can before he leaves home in 2 years. So at the moment I'm lecturing for the University of Otago, and I'm now the ethics advisor. And honestly, that is another thing I didn't see coming. Like, I think ethics has always been something that really fascinated me, but to be the advisor for our department has been super joyful. I really enjoy it. And I know you and I have been working on an idea for a book on ethics for a while now, and I'm really super motivated to get that underway, because I can see this big gap. So, yeah, I'm excited about that. And then, so I'm working at the University of Otago, also working in a project called Our Changing Coast, which is an endeavour-funded project looking at the impact of climate change and vertical land movement on coastal Aotearoa. And how to prepare communities for emergency events. And I've got a couple of PhD students that I look after who I'm meeting with actually over the next couple of days. I'm excited about that. And they're looking at how do we enable our rangatahi and tamariki with education to support them going into a future that is going to be so determined by climate change and vertical land movement impact. So there's those, and I sit on a couple of boards. I sit on Bay Trust, which is a community trust. We have a couple of $100 million invested, and we grant about $8 million a year into the wider Bay of Plenty community. And so the community trust, if you're unfamiliar with them, came out of the sale of our trust community trustee banks to Westpac many, many years ago. And the money from the sale of each bank was invested into a trust. And that trust, people are appointed by the government of the time to run that trust. So I'm on year 7 of my 8 years, which is quite a long time I've been with Bay Trust. And I also have the joy of sitting on another board based in Rotorua for an organisation called Wera Aotearoa Charitable Trust. And we do a lot of work in the in that central Bay of Plenty area around looking after families who have got hardship, looking after the health and well-being of the community, and now we're getting into building houses, so social houses, so that's exciting. And then I've got all my volunteer things, and I think that's pretty much where I'm at right now, but it's a happy place to be.
We talked to somebody, I've forgotten who it was, from the Bay Trust, and they were talking about the move to impact investing that you've been pushing.
Yeah.
And a move to social housing, a different model of funding social housing. How are they going?
They're both going really well. The impact investing is moving, and it's incredible where we're headed. We have always been a trust that has kind of paved the way for other trusts to follow. And what we're doing at the moment is building a lot of collaboration, even outside of the community trusts, into the other trusts as well. So there's trusts like Acorn and TET and all these other trusts that exist in all around the country. And so we're building these connections and collaborations with all the other trusts, because the more we can collectively put in the pot, the bigger the impact. So yeah, so we're working on some really cool things at the moment. This housing stuff's exciting, but we're also looking at how do we support the development of things like moving away from carbon credits and instead looking at like biodiversity credits. How do we support that kind of measure or an investment in the community? Because carbon credits are too aligned with radiata, and radiata has had its day. It has done so much damage in this community, especially like all down the East Coast. And it provides very little, and it's actually it's a bit of a twilight industry, but the industry doesn't want to think of itself like that. So there's still a lot of lobbying that's going on for something that has no future. So yeah, I find that quite interesting. So we're looking at how do we move away from that focus on climate, on carbon credits with radiata, and move over to a biodiversity credit instead. So we're building houses, obviously. Seems to be a theme in my life at the moment, but with the two organisations. And also looking at what land could we buy as a collective and reforest it in natives and actually start that movement. Like that movement starts with somebody driving it. So what would that look like if we started driving something like that? Yeah, so it's really cool stuff going on.
Wouldn't it be good if the pollution from forestry was some native plants instead of some pine trees?
That would be so good. Oh my gosh, I'd love that.
Ignoring the fact that it destroys the soil and the land.
Yeah.
They don't seem to be able to control it.
No, they don't. They definitely don't. And so I laugh out loud when I hear all the silly lobbying from the pine industry where they say that radiata makes an amazing nursery plant, but the problem is it doesn't make a nursery plant, and that's why people love radiata growing if you're a forester, because nothing grows under it. There is no understory. I think people need to be more willing to push back against that misinformation. And I think it's disinformation too.
Social housing's an interesting one, because it's the problem is deep systemic issues with how society is structured. Yeah. But the tool that a charitable trust has is money. And it's sort of, is it fighting fire with fire? It's a kind of a weird circular thing I can't quite get my head around.
It is. It's, I always think if you can, one of the biggest problems that people have is insecurity in their housing space. So all through the rest of the world, you don't buy a house, you don't usually buy a house with a view to flicking it off in 5 or 10 years to make some money. But in New Zealand, that's the mindset, that you buy a house, you put a tenant in it for a few years, you grab the tax back from it, and then you sell it off and make a big profit that you don't have to pay any tax on. So we've got this mindset. But the problem is that when we do that, we create instability in the lives of the people who rent the house. And so when the market's really buoyant, people all sell their houses, and then we've got all of a problem of all these houses on the market, all these tenants scrambling to try and find homes. All through the rest of the world, generally, you know, you have these intergenerational renting agreements where a house might be in a family for 2 or 3 generations, and it's the same family of 2 or 3 generations that rent the house. So it's a lifelong relationship. We don't have that here. So we end up at the moment, there are quite a few houses around, but because the market's not very buoyant at the moment, nobody's buying, so people are keeping their tenants in place. So it's not too bad a time to be looking for a rental. But as soon as things start, if interest rates drop down again, people start buying again and things become a bit more buoyant, then we end up with this big homelessness problem as all these houses are all selling and people aren't putting tenants in them. And what we can do as a charitable trust is take the money that we have, invest it into buying homes that are homes for life. So people, we hope that we'll be able to get people into them in a you buy it kind of relationship, but at the very least as a lifelong tenancy.
I don't know if you're hearing it, but it's doing...
I can't hear it.
You know the sort of the ding-dong noise it makes when it finds a new USB device?
Yeah.
Well, that's what it's doing constantly, like dungalum, dungalum, dungalum.
Bubble sprite of the forest of Orokanui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi aroha nui kia koutou ka tahu hau. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are, and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day, who you are, a triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last several years have been very tough, and it's so important that we give ourselves and each other the time, the space, the care, the compassion, the understanding, and the opportunity to share our story and be heard, and for others to share theirs and to listen. I'm so grateful to be a part of this show, so a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me. It's a real pleasure and privilege to be with you. And of course, as a species, we have evolved thanks to our capacity to adapt and find new ways of doing, being, seeing, feeling. And for all of us at this time of Easter, this time of transformation, we find ourselves, of course, looking toward a future that will require us to harness those integral skills of adaptation, which we all possess. I know for myself, in navigating change, it's always important to greet myself and the situation anew, without preconceptions, without expectations, without learnings from the past that may cloud my vision and perception of a new situation and path forward. And of course, when we are able to see our lives and ourselves and one another with new eyes in this way, often what we see changes for the better. And we start to understand ourselves and our surroundings with more clarity, with more compassion and gratitude, whether or not situations that arise meet any expectations that we may have come into this time with. And expectation, of course, is very interesting because part of who we are as a species is our innate creative skills. You know, we've created this whole human world and we are the great storytellers. And of course, we can spend our whole lives crafting and creating stories to enliven, to excite, to inspire, to torture, all these things. You know, there are so many ways that we can use our creativity, and expectation can be an aspect of that. So for me, I find when I'm encountering the new, it's always helpful to see where those expectations have originated from, whether I can give them space to be my creation, or whether I begin to identify with them, find a sense of self within them. And again, the more I can release these expectations, the more I can be pleasantly surprised with what arises. So I really hope for you, whatever new environments, whatever new opportunities, whatever new ways of doing, being, seeing, feeling are presenting themselves to you, you can recognize yourself anew in each moment. That not only do we possess a storied past, but a storied future. And these stories that we choose to tell, that we choose to craft, that we choose to live, that we choose to let go of, can really be our allies in how we coexist with other living stories in the world. I talk to you now from a very beautiful and rainy Portobello, where I'm staying with my beautiful whānau here in Ōtiporti, Dunedin. And I feel grateful to be here with you in this time. It is starting to get colder. The nights are getting longer. And I know that there's so many exciting surprises waiting for us all. So thank you again for having me, and I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Ka kite.
Thank you, Tahu. You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're just chatting today.
We haven't had a catch-up for so long. Sam, you've got a new grandbaby coming.
We have. Most exciting.
That is exciting. When is Bubba due?
20th of May.
Well, how many does that make? Does that make two?
That makes one.
Oh, I always think Lucy.
Yeah, that makes one for me and two for Lucy. So three altogether.
Oh, that's so exciting. That is going to be really lovely. And how is that going to change your life? Retirement and total focus on helping to raise grandbabies, hopefully.
I think retirement's some way off.
Oh, that doesn't... Imagine this, though. Like, I'll paint the picture for you. You hand in your resignation, you retire, you swim more, you spend more time with the grandbabies, you write a book on ethics with me, and all manner of other really fun things that don't involve going to work.
Yeah, there's a small matter of getting paid for going to work.
Oh, that's right, that old thing. That seems so unfair.
Maybe we could resolve that problem.
Yeah, let's resolve that problem. I'll figure out something we can do. You could always come and do some work with me. What does the rest of this year look like for you?
I've got lots of student. I've got got lots of people in the sort of final stages of their doctorate. So getting all of those prepared is quite exciting. And as I'm sure you remember, it sort of gets quite not tense, but it gets sort of high stakes as you get closer to this. It's quite exciting, but also quite exhausting. It's an interesting time as you try to help people pull together what they've been working on for years and decades, if you take their whole professional practice, and pulling all that together into a single coherent argument is an interesting task. However many you're sort of doing, however much you do in terms of like weekly work, there's a limit to how many of those you can hold in your head.
Yeah.
It's an interesting little challenge around thinking about that. And I've got lots of papers at various stages of production. The one that you're most aware of, the Decolonizing Computing Education, is getting lots of interest. We're busily applying for funding to extend that out beyond computing to other disciplines, because the approach seems to be working in terms of generating the professional framework of practice statements. What we've got to do next is to demonstrate that we can get from there to changing teaching and teaching resources and things, but that seems to be the, let's say, the easy bit. I think we've broken the back of it by getting to that framework in a really cool way, using your stories and retelling those stories in lots of different ways. That was so exciting when that came together. That's been accepted for a big conference in Dublin. Working on lots of things about how to teach professional practice and how people learn from professional practice, very much doubling down on the ideas of necessarily insider. Insider research is normally seen as a bad thing, and the ethics books or the research books will talk about insider research, but they'll talk about it in usually about half a chapter and pretty much telling you not to do it.
Yeah, without seeming really understanding the value and the power of it when it's done correctly.
Yeah, but it's the necessarily insider bit is that this is actually about research that you could not do if you weren't an insider. And
exactly.
This research could not happen if you're an insider. And yes, you could find other ways of studying those same things, but they would be a much weaker take on it, a much weaker understanding. So what does that mean in terms of how we do research, how we fund research, how we do professional practice in lots of different areas? That's keeping me busy. And the other one, the one we haven't got a proper name for, the one we refer to as the isms.
Yeah.
That we think we've changed. We're changing to positive isms. So the idea that if we look at a problem, we can identify what the drivers are, but also what the levers for change are at a whole lot of different levels.
Mm.
One of the papers that we submitted this year didn't get rejected, but the reviewers said, I don't really like the fact you're using isms because it brings up, do you know it's used for things like sexism and racism? That's what we're doing. That's where we got it from. But if that is being seen as a problem, then let's actually lean into that a bit and make sure we're working with that. And so we're referring to it as the positivisms.
Yep.
Which is kind of deliberately provocative on the positivist.
Yes.
When we're trying to sort of get beyond that, well, recognize the importance of that, because we want things like drugs trials to use that. But in terms of understanding social systems and how people work in businesses and things, then let's get beyond that a little bit and actually tell some stories and take a much more narrative and creative approach. So we need to be able to look at how we can do those things better.
Do you think it's alarming that a person can like look at that paper and not understand exactly what you just said, the isms? Yes, there is a whole negative connotation that goes with them, but that doesn't tell the whole story. That person's lack of critical approach that doesn't enable them to see the other side of that And that kind of, that's reflective of just how the whole world seems to be thinking at the moment, indoctrinated into one way of thinking and unable to see the other side of it.
Yeah, but they also said it was the best paper they'd read in years. So yeah. I don't want to be too critical of their critical opinion.
Well, that's a good thing.
But yeah, I think it's and people are sort of running scared of that. We've got other work going on at the moment using the Dave Gurdjieff's approach, the Victor Morphosis approach of retelling stories, reducing stories down to a little nugget and then retelling them. Yeah. Using lots of different genres, that's another thing that we've been working on that's really getting quite a bit of legs and quite some traction. We've got a paper nearly ready to submit for an international conference on taking the idea of redaction. Yep. So at the moment, for a long time, people sort of on the sides of computing, people like me, have been pushing away, trying to look at the relationship between computer science and sustainability and social justice and climate change and so on. We're not a big community, but we're there. So many of my colleagues around the world are saying that their research has just been defunded, or that the rules for the funds that they've been applying to have just changed to basically say you can't do that work. So even beyond the people saying that accusing this work as being woke or devious. Remember, woke used to be a positive term, but it's been turned into a negative term. But on a more general, this work has just been defunded. I was talking to somebody last week in the States whose research was funded in October, I think it was, last year. So they've been busily, spending that money, using that money, paying for research assistance and so on. And that money's just been clawed back.
Whoa.
On the basis that because it had a DEIA component in the fund, that's now deemed to be illegal. Therefore, that fund shouldn't have been allocated.
That's crazy.
So huge swathes of work, of research, are now being deemed not able to be done.
We've got a couple of political parties in Aotearoa at the moment who are trying to apply those same kind of rules here. Do you think it's actually going to catch on, or do you think that there's going to be enough just that the government departments are just going to ignore them and just get part? We've got a year and a half to go till the end of this government. Do you think we're just going to keep on going with life? Well,
I think it's already happened. I mean, we saw them go through the Marsden Fund.
Yeah.
And, we saw senior ministers going down the lists of papers of research that had been done and saying, how is this paper? Look here, it's got something about gender in ancient China. How is that going to help our society? Gone.
Yeah, without actually understanding what the actual paper was about. And that's what we noticed too. Anything that had the word Māori in it, gone.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so how should responsible researchers who are driven, motivated to do that kind of work and have a strong imperative to do that kind of work, how should they respond? Mm. So we've been doing a little thing with six researchers from around the world, most of whom we've had on the show, starting with a little nugget. So reducing that story down to a little nugget of we ended up with a little picture, a little stick figure of a person reading a paper, like a piece of paper, and it says, in this paper, and then the rest of the speech bubbles blanked out.
And
So that was the starting point for the stories that people worked on. And so we ended up with 41 different stories. I say stories, some of them are poems and some of them are drawings, that explore redaction and how we might respond to not just the words being redacted, but the whole idea of this area being banned, and then using that just as a way into looking at things. And so we've got more work going on, we should actually talk about doing a whole show on the basis of those stories. We could perhaps read them and think that would be fun to do, actually, wouldn't it? We should do that.
Yeah, let's do that.
We should so do that. One of them's Winnie the Pooh. That's fun.
I bet.
I wonder if that would work. Yeah, because you could still just say redact. Because even though we didn't, it wasn't supposed to be about redaction as such. There was, and we didn't specify how to do it. A few people actually like put redactions into the words that they were doing into their text. So it's about exploring how do we respond to that and how can we deal with all that sort of stuff. One of the people who worked on that, Ian Brooks, wrote a paper last year, the year before, called Tech for Bad, where he looked at the computer professionals who are supporting the oil industry, mainly in the North Sea. And knowing that that is a sunset industry, knowing that that is a bad, in quotes, industry, how are the people who are working in that industry rationalizing that in terms of their personal beliefs or in terms of their knowledge that they're working in this industry? That it, while yes, we at the moment we're still in a transition, we still need it, it's, you know, not there for the long term. And what's interesting is that those discussions hadn't happened. So the discussions or the thinking about what is computing's relationship as their career to working in this area, that's like a taboo area. For those people, they hadn't had that discussion, or at least they talked to them and it was like news to them. Yes, they knew that there was this was bad, and they knew that that didn't sit with their own personal beliefs, but none of them had actually like gone through that thought process of I'm doing it, it's okay. And it's certainly not written down, and there's no guidance on how to do that. So we're going to do a fictomorphosis process to see if, to see how we can better understand that relationship. So it's proving to be really exciting. Dave has almost submitted his doctorate, so it's going to be a shame that we don't get to talk to Dave on a weekly basis. It's been a really exciting journey with Dave. We'll have to start up another podcast so we can talk to Dave every week.
That would be lovely to be able to talk to Dave every week. He's the most positive, wonderful human being. He's so lovely.
Okay, so how could we make that show work if we're talking, if we're going through those stories? We could just read, is it just a matter of reading them out, or do we need to get like, do we need to act them?
Oh, that'd be fun, acting out the stories. Oh, that's like the old, you know, remember the old Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy started off as a radio show. We did a radio show of Dave's stories.
Let's have a look at that. We shall do that. Right, let's put some more music on. Let's have, my choice this time, let's have Belle and Sebastian, I Want the World to Stop.
lightning. Alabama City, yes, this is your art. This is your bows at your bedside and your bar.
I'd like to do that. I'd be keen to be part of that. So we've got time, is what I'm saying. We could actually do something with this because we've got space and time to do it.
Yeah, they're not very long. I'll send them to you.
Okay. Because would we have discussion after each one, or what would we do it? How would we do it? What would we do it with?
I'll send them to you. Let's have a think about it.
Yeah, I was going to say that because I'm looking at the top of the time ticking down, and I've got to get on the road soon.
Okay, let's go. So what are your plans for the rest of the year?
I was going to ask you the same thing. Well, I did. So the rest of this year, I was just thinking about it. There's one third of it gone already, Sam. One whole third of the year has already just vanished.
No, we're just at the start, surely.
Oh, it feels like that. I still feel like saying Happy New Year to people when I haven't seen them. But it's already like a third of the year is gone. So I think the rest of this year is just supporting Jack and his NCEA and mountain biking, growing that for our region, and then just keeping on doing my paid work as well, which enables all the fun stuff. But, you know, and it's even more than that because I find my work fun. I really enjoy it. It makes me happy. Finally found the right balance of things that helps my ADHD brain to just be satisfied. I feel really satisfied in my life at the moment. Yeah, that's a nice place to be, Sam, I have to say.
That's a cool place to be.
It is, yeah. It's just taken like 53 years to find that. So I'm loath to mess with anything. I've got exactly everything right now.
And talking about messing with things, how's the sourdough going and the bread?
Oh, my bread is amazing, and I've got so much sourdough out in the world because I started dehydrating it. So I've just if any of our listeners want any sourdough, just let me know and I'll send them some dehydrated starter. And because I just love that I made this dehydrated starter that's gone literally around the world of my three. So I've got Cisco, which is my San Francisco starter that's 177 years old, and then I've got Bread Zeppelin, which is my Whakatane wild yeast starter, which is coming up to a year old. And then Missy, who's my Mississippi starter, that's 150 something years old. And they've got that Cisco and Missy have got it's very well established and well known histories, which is really, it's neat. There's a whole whakapapa to sourdough. And so I've got the whakapapa to those two sourdoughs. And, of course, you know, Bread Zeppelin I started myself here in Whakatane. And I feel deeply satisfied making bread. I love making bread. I love the smell of it. I love the process of it. I love the sharing of it, the growing of my knowledge of bread making, everything about it, really. Anyway, we could do a whole show just on bread, Sam. On sourdough, all the things I can make with sourdough starter.
Whakapapa of the sourdough.
Yeah, because it does have a whakapapa. There's a whole story and lineage that goes with it. And I'm excited because I get to be just like I'm, you know, like as a mum, I've made Jack, and I came from my dad who came from his dad, who, you know, like there's a whole whakapapa to us as humans, but also something like a sourdough starter also has a whakapapa. It's a living organism that has been handed down for generation after generation after generation. And my friend Pam was over the other day from Utah, and she's taken some Bread Zeppelin, my Whakatane wild yeast, back to Utah with her in its powdered form. Hopefully it doesn't get pulled up looking like drugs. Terrible.
How do you dehydrate it? How do you not?
Well, I just put it in my dehydrator on the leather, fruit leather tray of my dehydrator. You just put it on there.
And but it does it reduce down to like a paste, or how does it get?
No, it goes down to like a hard thick, like a crack, almost like a cracker, and then you just put it in the food processor and grind it up to a powder, and then put it in a bag, and then put it in the freezer.
It doesn't sound like a thing that something should survive, does it?
No, but it does. And there was, I was reading this amazing story about this big clay pot in Egypt that had this powder in that somebody suspected might have been sourdough, and sourdough starter, and it was, and they rehydrated it, and it's making bread, and it's 4,000 years old.
Wow.
4,000 year old. Crazy. Yeah, and actually, my Cisco, which is my 177 year old one, that one, who knows how old that was? That's what we know, that 177 years ago it ended up in San Francisco, but where did it come from before that? Anybody knows? That would be amazing to find out. But yeah, and I wonder if they could do DNA testing to try and figure that out.
I was thinking more about the taste testing. Can you taste the difference?
Oh my gosh, yes. All my three starters, they behave differently. They need to be fed differently. They definitely taste different, and they smell different. I can pick up the jar and tell you which one it is by the smell. Yeah, so they're very, very different from each other.
And for a while you were supplying a bakery.
Yeah, I was, but then it just became just a step too far in my life. Yeah. I would have to actually quit something that paid me. I actually found something that I couldn't do. I was doing it, but the problem was that it just it ran the risk of stopping being fun, because the pressure of having to provide that all the time. And if it's not fun, I don't want to do it. I know that about myself now. I'm just not very good at doing things that I don't find fun. Luckily, I find most things really fun. Just, living is fun.
Is it that we've managed to find ourselves jobs, several jobs, that we find fun? Or do you think that you could find anything fun?
That's what it is. I was thinking about that the other day too. I was talking to someone else about it who said, how do you just stay happy all the time? And I'm just happy. And if you're happy, you can find fun in everything. And I think I go purposely looking for the joy, Sam. That's what I do, is I purposely go like hunt out the joy, like a kid looking for eggs in the garden at Easter. You hunt out the joy, and I'll hunt out the joy in every job that I've got, so that I stay wanting to do it.
Sounds good to me. Let's go out to be happy.
Yes, I love that.
I expect to hear you whistling along. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Ain't got no place to lay your head. Somebody came and took your bed. Don't worry, be happy. The landlord say your rent is late. He may have to litigate. Don't worry, be happy.
Look at me, I'm happy. Don't worry.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.